I will now call on the last speaker of the day, who is going to speak about the Chinese experience, which is again a vast migration of Chinese out of China and back to China, and with very different cultural interactions with the host institutions. Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot to give your name. Dr. Shou Yue Wang from Cal State Polytechnic University in Pomona.
How do I maximize the screen? Okay. Let's not trip her.
Oh, wait a minute. So you have to resign.
Alex. So the bottom half is not shown up. Thank you very much. I know I'm the last speaker, so I'm going to make it quick. What Alexa said about language reminds me of an anecdote I heard from people who work in the Silicon Valley, that apparently what people say what's going on in Silicon Valley is that at the beginning of each day, there will be the manager who most likely will be a indigenous American, let's just say, who will have the group leaders together. They will talk about what they need to do. So you have a group leader who will be Chinese, ethnic Chinese, another one who might be Indian, another who will be Russian. So they have this meeting, and then they all go back, the leaders will go back to their group. They will talk in Chinese, Indian, Russian, and to their group members and get things done. So I don't know how true that is, but apparently that's one version of what's going on in the Silicon Valley. I don't know whether some of you may recognize some of the faces here. I don't know. There are a couple of Nobel Prize winning physicists there. That's a hint? Anybody recognize Ng Yang? That'll be the second from the right. T.D. Lee, who I guess has slimmed down quite a bit from his student days, was the extreme right. Apparently, the story was that he fell in love with a Chinese student, and so he was determined to lose some weight during this period when he was a graduate student at the University of Chicago. The two men on the left is the other half of my study. On the extreme left, that's Guangya, Zhu Guangya, who went back to China in 1950, became a leader of the Chinese nuclear project. And next to him was Zhang Wenyu, Wenyu Zhang, who became the leader of the Chinese high energy physicist community in China. So this project really is a part of a larger project on Chinese American scientists, not just the physicists, but the physicists is a big part of it, partly because I was trained as a physicist, and so I'm more familiar with the physicists in this group. But this really project looks at the history of Chinese-American scientists from post-World War II period all the way to the present. And I put a dash in the title when I call Chinese-American scientists to make this point. That is, I'm tracking both those who stayed in the U.S., who might became Americans, right, who might be properly called the Chinese-American scientists, and also those who returned to China in the 1950s, so who were not technically Chinese-American scientists, who were American-trained Chinese scientists. So my study actually compared and contrasted these two groups, because interesting enough, in the more recent period, the two groups actually came together in interesting ways. So the main argument I'm trying to make with this project, the two parts to that argument. One is the idea that historians have used the word Americanization to talk about what happened in the world of science, especially in the post-World War II period. The idea is simply that the U.S. had maintained such a lead in many ways and also had huge influence on what goes on in the scientific world, in the rest of the world. But historians are also interested in terms of the limits, and both the extent but also the limit of of this Americanization process in science. So this is part of what I'm be looking at. But the other part, the reverse or the parallel process in the post-war period is what we might call the internationalization or transnationalization of American science itself. I saw that Alex used the term the de-Americanization of American science. I think the idea is the same. The idea is that how, and also the first speaker also talked about this diversification of this large number of immigrant scientists present in the American scientific community. So the idea is also how the American scientific community itself was transformed in the post-war period, largely by the infusion of immigrant scientists. Before that, as Alan talked about how the coming of the refugee scientists, but in the post-war period, large numbers came from Asia, from China, mainland China, Taiwan, India, but also, as Alexei pointed out, from Britain and also from Russia in the more recent period. And the point that unifies these two aspects is the idea that the presence of immigrant scientists in the U.S. actually helped to further the Americanization process itself, because even those who came to the U.S. then maintained the close ties with their countries of origin, and often they will play very prominent roles in the science and education policy back in their home countries, such as China. So that will further actually spread American influence of doing science. And then vice versa, the presence of all these immigrants from over the world in the U.S. produced this kind of hybridization process, effect, which then, you know, in many ways further strengthened American science. So the two sides, I argue, are interrelated. A little bit more on the background of how I came to study this. Interestingly enough, actually, I was not, by training either, I was not a historian of Chinese science, even though I was trained a physicist in China. My PhD thesis was actually on the U.S. science policy during the Cold War. Just a couple of years ago, I published it as a book with the title In Sputnik's Shadow. It's on the history of the U.S. President's Science Advisory Committee, established by Eisenhower after Sputnik went up in 1957, and George Kistikovsky was both a science advisor to Eisenhower, also chairman of this group. So this is actually my own specialty, but what has made me interested in Chinese-American science and also Chinese science in these connections, one was I became more interested in this once I developed more distance with Chinese science, because at first I felt I could not be objective in my historical studies of Chinese science. But having done a lot of research on American science, I felt that I can have the distance, the perspective to study Chinese history of science. But also the current discussion, as you may remember, President Obama made the comment in his recent State of Union address how China and India may have presented our own Sputnik moment. So there's also that connection. I want to understand what exactly is the new challenge in to U.S. science policy. And what I have argued is that in order to understand what's happening in China, we have to understand the history of Chinese-American scientists. I argue that they played a central role in the history of science in China. So in a way, what I'm arguing is that U.S. science has been the story of a transnational science. And by the same token, the development of science in China has also been a transnational story. And so both those two groups of Chinese-American scientists, those who have stayed and those who returned to China, I argue, are central to understanding the rise of Chinese science. And so I actually received an ASF grant to study Chinese-American scientists that I'm... So this is kind of a progress report as to my research in this direction. And one of the interesting comments is that I can find more materials on Chinese-American scientists in China in Chinese than in English, because I guess they are bigger fish in the smaller pond, in a way. In China than it's here. Roughly, we can divide this group into several generations. There was a very small number of Chinese scientists who came here before World War II. Perhaps the most prominent would be H.S. Chan, the rocket scientist at Caltech, who eventually, in 1955, he wanted to go back to China in 50 after his security clearance was revoked, but he was under detention and house arrest for quite a few years. Finally, he was allowed to go back to China in 1955 as a result of the Geneva Convention, when he was essentially traded for U.S. POWs held in China, and along with other Chinese scientists in that period. But the largest number, the starting point for my project was about 5,000 of Chinese students in the U.S. by 1949, when the communists took over mainland China. Most of them came after World War II, although a few actually came at the later stage of World War II, such as Sein Yang actually came, I think, either 44, 45, before the end of the war. Li came after the war. But there were about 5,000 of them. Many of them had already received their PhD just around that time. So if you figure they came in 44, 45, 46, so a number of them already began to get their PhDs by 49, 50. So they faced the choice of where they should go once they got their PhD. So that's the main target of my study. But as I said, I'm trying to bring up the story all the way to the present, partly because in order to understand what happened to that 49 generation, it's important also to understand their interactions with the later generation and vice versa. In order to understand the later generation, we need to understand better the 49 generation who are in their 80s and 90s. So that's why I started with them as a kind of rescue mission to try to talk to some of the survivors who are still alive today and get their story. So the next group in this kind of chronology will be the generation that came from Taiwan. Many of them actually were born in mainland China, may have received some education in mainland before they fled with their family to Taiwan in 49 or so. And so many of them received their university education in Taiwan, and mostly actually from Taiwan University, the most elite university in Taiwan, before they came to the U.S. for graduate studies in the 1950s. So people like Chang Lingtian, actually here in the picture is Wen Hao Li, who came a little bit later, came out of that generation. That's also a very important generation who played important roles, not only in American science or in Taiwan, but also actually in mainland China as well, because many of them, again, still felt attachment to their home place. And the last generation will be kind of my kind of generation, people who came to the U.S. After the U.S. and Chinese renormalization of the relations, especially the reestablishment of diplomatic relations in 1979. I came in 1986, and a large number, I think, came in the 80s to pursue graduate degrees, mostly in science and engineering. And the picture there on the lower right hand is Xiaodong Wang, who has distinction of being the first from this group to be elected member of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. Before I was preparing this talk, he was a biologist, unfortunately, I guess, for us. I was trying to see whether a physicist has made it into that rank. Apparently, from what I know, not yet so far. There's a second biological scientist who was elected from that group to the U.S. National Academy. And there's another group quite distinct from all the above, that is native-born Chinese-American scientists like Stephen Chu, who was born in the U.S., but he was born to parents who were of the 1949 generation. His father came as a scientist before 49 and decided to stay. And there were quite other people who belonged to that group, but Chen, I forgot his first name, who won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry from San Diego, also was born to parents who are apparently cousins of H.S. Chan, the rocket scientist. So a quick overview of Chinese students in the U.S. The very first wave came in the late 19th century, came to Yale, and then next one came in the 1870s. And then perhaps the most important group was the group who came in the early 20th century with what's called the Boxer Rebellion indemnity fellowships. Essentially, it was the money the Chinese government had to pay the U.S. for the damage and loss during the Boxer Rebellion of the 1900. It turned out that the U.S. claims were vastly exaggerated, and so as a kind of gesture, the U.S. Agreed to return the excessive claims, but with the condition that the money had to be used to send students to the U.S. or for educational purpose. And so part of that, I mean, it's a long, very complicated story, but part of that was used to select about 70 students each year from China to send to the U.S. to study science and engineering. Later on, it was also used to fund the Tsinghua School and now Tsinghua University as a major technical school in Beijing. So altogether, I think there were about 1,000 or so of Chinese students who came on that fellowship, and actually Sun Yang came on that fellowship to study in the U.S., and those who returned to China before World War II all became leaders, almost all of them became founders of their fields in China, in the universities, and also in the central government agency for science, the Academia Sinica in mainland. So some interesting pictures. This may have been the picture that made the Qing government to stop sending students to the U.S. They quickly Americanized too quickly. And this is the group, I think this is the second group of Chinese students who came on the Boxer Fellowship. One of them was Zhu Keden, who became the founder of meteorology and geography in many ways in modern China. Hu Shi, who later became the Chinese ambassador to the U.S. In the 1940s, and also Zhao Yuanren, they are part of this group of Boxer Fellows. And so interestingly enough, perhaps the most influential Chinese general scientific society, it's called the Science Society of China, was actually founded by this group in Cornell University in 1914. They later moved the society back to China. They published a journal, it's called Science in China, became the most influential journal in science in China as well. So this is when they went back to China and held their national annual meetings. So this is the group that, this is a picture of a group who came to the U.S., and Chen was part of this group, I think, is in the middle somewhere. And again, quickly as a background on science in China in the mainland, after the Communist Revolution of 49, the 5,000 in the U.S. had to decide what they were going to do. Eventually, about 1,000 actually went back to China, even after that revolution, and about 4,000 stayed in the U.S. And so what happened to them was that those who returned to China actually became leaders even more more in a way than the Boxer Fellows in the sense because they brought the most cutting-edge scientific research. Although very few of them were actually involved in any kind of a secret research in the U.S., but when they did go back to China, they brought the cutting-edge scientific knowledge with them and quickly became leaders in various fields, including defense-related scientific research, including nuclear and rocket science. And those who stayed in the U.S. also strove to achieve excellence in their fields because most other professional advancement routes were close to them because of the political situation in the 1950s during the McCarthy era. So again, some pictures. So Li and Yang with Zhu, who I said, as I said, went back to China, became the leader of the Chinese nuclear weapons project, who actually just died a couple of weeks ago. And he was best friends with especially Li. There's interesting background to their coming to the U.S. After World War II, the Chinese nationalist government wanted to build its own atomic bomb. And so Chiang Kai-shek, the leader, asked the scientists, so how do we do? How do we make an atomic bomb? The scientists said, one, you need a lot of money. Two, you need to train a lot of people. And so as part of the second objective, they selected about a half a dozen top students in physics, chemistry, and mathematics, and sent them over to the U.S. to learn how to make an atomic bomb. And of course, when they came here, they were in for a surprise that they can't get in any of the Los Alamos or any of the weapons-making labs. So they decide to pursue graduate studies instead. So Li and Zhu, the two men on the two sides, were the physics students selected, the two, to study, you know, to make atomic bombs. And both end up studying nuclear and particle physics. Zhu received his degree from Michigan, I think, in nuclear physics, and quickly went back in 1950. And the picture of interesting historical value. Sun Yang on the left, his younger brother on the right, and the man in the middle is Deng Jiaxian, who also went back quickly. He then got his nuclear physics PhD from Purdue and also was a major architect of the Chinese atomic bomb project. So you think that you know, after the communists took over mainland China, the U.S. government would stop them from going back, right? Initially, actually, it was the contrary. They will actually encourage the Chinese students to go back. As a matter of fact, once the mainland changed hand, a lot of students lost their family financial support. So the U.S. government actually established a fund for them to apply to continue their studies. As a condition for their application was that they had to agree to go back to China, which is really interesting. It was the kind of traditional American missionary kind of spirit of spreading American technology all over the world. And they probably felt that, even in the communist country, American science could change things eventually. What changed things eventually was, of course, the Korean War. And even, interestingly enough, not after the break of the outbreak of the Korean War, students were still allowed to go back and in some cases encouraged to go back. And not even after the Chinese entry into the war, it's only about a year afterwards. Then finally the bureaucracy fought this thing out because the State Department and the Justice Department and the Pentagon disagree with each other as to what to do. But eventually they issued a ban, federal government issued a ban. Anyone who studied science, engineering, agriculture, medicine, were not allowed to go back. But by then, several hundreds already went back. So why do they want to return? I have interviewed some and read their biographies, autobiographies. To me, there are several reasons. Yes, there was this sense of attachment to China. Some of them came on government scholarship, so they felt they have an obligation. But many of them were disillusioned with the nationalist government that they left. So they felt that they gave the benefit of doubt to the new government, although they knew very little about the communists, but they felt that at least on paper, in rhetoric, everything they read about the new government seems to be very supportive of science. So I think that's one reason. And another is their experience in the U.S. Remember, this is still Jim Crow, McCarthy era, both political and racial discrimination. Many of them had personal experience, couldn't find a place to rent outside of the university, all kinds of incidents that disillusioned them from being able to stay here. And yes, there's also the official U.S. immigration policy that radically restricted their options. This is a period after World War II. They did repeal the Chinese exclusion law, which had essentially banned Chinese from staying in the U.S. But the quota for annual immigration for any Chinese is based on ethnicity, not based on country. So any Chinese from anywhere in the world to the U.S. was restricted to 105, right? And so you had practically no hope of actually getting a legal residency during that period by that means. I remember a story that Chan Yin-tian told me when he, this is the early 50s, when he applied to the immigration authority for residence, they told him, you probably will need to wait for 100 years in order to get your quota. And he said, that will give me an incentive to live very long. And but eventually, the Cold War did intervene and help them, those who decided to stay. But the to finish the story about those who decided to return, another important factor was that many of them had very strong family connections in China. Some had spouses in China, had children, some even. And so many of those people who were married, of course, they decided to go back to China. And they were organized into various groups. The two most prominent groups were the Chinese students, Christian student associations, and the probably even more liberal Association of Chinese Scientific Workers. The organizations to help each other to return, because fairly soon the U.S. government began to put obstacles as to whether they could return to China. And this is indication how they were disaffected by the nationalist government. This is the play they put on the students as satire against the nationalist government. So some of the early returnees. This is a picture with Hua Luogeng, perhaps the best known Chinese mathematician, who was already a professor by then at University of Illinois, and he decided to return and actually published an open letter in the Chinese press in the U.S. Calling on other Chinese students to return to China, in which he mentioned very prominently the racial discrimination against the Chinese as one of the reasons that they should return to China. And this is a Chen who was put on trial in a way. He was accused of being a member of the U.S. Communist Party. And so he could not return. He bought the ticket for, I think it was this boat, the August, this President Wilson, but he was prevented from boarding, but there were a large number who did go. Among those who did go, there were three who had stayed at Caltech, and they were detained on their way when the boat stopped in Yokohama in Japan. Because of the publicity about De Chen, and so they were detained and their luggage was searched, but eventually they were allowed to go on to back to China after a huge protest worldwide. European scientists were involved in this. And one of them was a nuclear physicist to the right, Zhao Zhongyao, who did not participate in the Chinese bomb project, but he was viewed as a founder of nuclear physics. When he first studied in Caltech in the 30s, he did an experiment that actually now is recognized as perhaps among the first indications of positron, but it was not properly recognized at the time. So he went back to China, came back to the U.S. in the 40s, and went back again in 1950. And so finally in 1951, September 1951, the U.S. government came to the decision to stop the Chinese students from going back. And the first actual act was carried out when a boat carrying a large number of Chinese students reached Honolulu. So the boat, you know, the students were allowed to go to the land for excursion. When they came back on the boat, there was officials from U.S. Immigration who had a list of people. They were calling on the names, and some of the students were helping them locate their names because they couldn't pronounce their names properly, so they helped them to locate their names. But once they locate their names on the list, they were asked to step aside. Eventually, about nine Chinese students who already received their PhDs now were not allowed to reboard the boat, because they studied the science, and this is the first time it was implemented. So That's why I use the title American Iron Curtain. And then one of them was Xie Jialin, who had received his PhD from Stanford. So he was not allowed to go back to China. So what did he have to do? He went back, worked as a kind of research associate at Stanford in one of the labs, eventually found a job in Chicago designing an accelerator for medical use in one of the hospitals. Apparently, it was a very good accelerator. He found out some years back in the 70s or 80s when he came back for a visit, they were still using the accelerators that he designed. He eventually became the chief designer of the Beijing electron positron collider built in the 80s in Beijing. And so this is the order, 1951, issued to a lot of the Chinese students, telling them that you cannot go back. And this is Xie Jialin, who went to Chicago and began to work on medical research. Some of the students, here's what they were told: not only they cannot go back, they cannot attempt to go back. Right? If you attempt to go back, there'll be a violation of the rules that land you in detention facilities at Ellis Island. So some of the students, were actually detained for months because they attempt to return to China. So finally, during the after the end of the Korean War, they felt that there's no reason to hold them any longer. So some of them began to organize. They can't organize openly because that'll be viewed as attempt to go back to China, and they could put them in jail. So they organized themselves kind of somewhat secretly, organized campaigns, wrote letters, and contacted ACLU for help, and even contacted Einstein. Einstein apparently said, I'd love to help you, but I don't carry that much weight with the U.S. government. But finally, they did publish a letter to the president, appeal to Eisenhower to allow them to go back, in which they made a point of how America has always been generous in spreading technology around the world, and they had touched no secret research, and even just for humanitarian reasons, they should be allowed to go back. But eventually, that's not an argument that changed the U.S. government position. It's the Geneva Conference when the U.S. and Chinese government negotiated for the exchange of personnel. So the Chinese government actually demanded the return of Chinese scientists. So there were about 100 or so of Chinese students and scientists who returned to China. So this is a letter from the U.S. immigration that telling them that the earlier order is lifted. So for more on this 49 generation, I had done some research and wrote up the results and published a paper on this last year in the journal ISIS. So if anyone is interested in that, you can email me too. I can send you a copy of that. So what happened to those who returned? As I said, many of them became leaders in their various fields, especially in defense research. So those actually fared better during the various political campaigns. But even those, even in the defense sector, some of them were not protected during the Cultural Revolution. Quite a few actually suffered a great deal. They became prominent again with Nixon's trip, which did a lot to boost the morale and positions of American educated Chinese scientists, because during the Cultural Revolution, a lot of those were accused of being American agents or American spies and suffered a great deal. But what's really interesting is what I found was that even some of them, even people like Chen, who was really very upset with his treatment in the U.S., still carried a lot of the ways of how to do science with him back to China. For example, he was very unhappy with the way the Chinese universities were restructured along the Soviet model. And that's apparently one of the reasons he was involved in the founding of the University of Science and Technology as part of the Chinese Academy of Sciences, which is still today one of the elite universities in China. And here's an interesting number. A survey of leading Chinese scientists in the 80s, and it shows how strong the American influence was among the top Chinese scientists. About 60% 60% of all those Chinese students who study abroad were studying in the U.S. And I think of all the members of the top scientists, large numbers actually did study abroad. I don't have time to go through all the slides, so I'll just quickly summarize this. Those who stayed in the U.S., actually one of the most important events in their lives was the Nixon's trip to China, which allowed them to speak and to act in the interest of U.S.-China scientific relations. And some slides, Li and Yang with other Nobel laureates. The Nixon trip really was a turning point. So Yang came back to visit, was met with Mao, and apparently talked physics. And also Yang met with his friend, remember Deng Jiaxian? Now they had a reunion after about 20 years or so. Large numbers of Chinese American scientists went back, C.S. Wu. I know this warms heart of Dr. Kohler. But 78 was also important because before that, the Chinese government refused to send students officially to study in the U.S., almost holding that as a kind of bargaining chip because the American university really wanted the Chinese students. They said, we haven't had Chinese students for a generation, so we really want them to come. So after the diplomatic relations was established, a large number began to come. And Yang actually played an active role in advocating normalization. And the Chinese-American scientists continue to be very influential in Chinese science policy. And one of the important projects sponsored by T.D. Lee was the Cuspia Prize, some of you may be familiar with. They also published a journal. It's called a Science Technology Review in China. That's very influential, not only in science, but also in political reforms in China. I was a graduate student. I remember reading that journal. So, and that was actually effort of several generations. Then Tiananmen put a dent in exchange. This is Fang Lizhi. But T.D. Lee actually kind of brought a message back and forth between the two governments. What has happened after Tiananmen is interesting. Kind of emergence of a transnational scientific community within the Chinese American scientists. I once showed this a picture at Stony Brook. People were stunned that Li and Yang actually sat in the same room because of their personal animosity for a long time. And this is the Beijing positron electron positron collider. Pief Panofsky helped a lot with the building. Again, that Stanford connection. And T.D. Lee was the biggest promoter of that project. And Yang actually disagreed with Lee on high-energy physics. Lee promoted basic research, and Yang advocated more applied research. Other people who have been influential in other parts of the Greater China science policy. More recently, the rise of the Chinese economy has drawn more Chinese students to go back. So we talk about the circulation. This is very much going on, as everybody knows. This picture of Stephen Chu. We wonder whether his appointment has something to do with the idea of U.S.-China working on global warming. I think there's probably some to that. So just very briefly, what I'm trying to do now is to do research, interview some of the survivors from the earliest generation, but also to actually take a look at the American men of science, men and women of science. I have located in the 67th edition about 1,200 of Chinese scientists listed in that, so I'm making a database of that. And the last point I want to leave with you is I'm hoping everyone here will help me, everybody you know, who hear my talk or read my papers will help me by sending me your stories of either, even if you're not a Chinese-American scientist yourself, you have worked with either as a student or as a mentor to give me feedback about the history of Chinese-American scientists. Because one of the points I'm trying to argue is this kind of hybridization, the idea of, I think earlier speakers mentioned, this idea of bringing really, in the U.S., we have this worlding, if we can use that as a verb, of science, right? Bringing the different styles together, this infusion of different styles, that's really the strength of American science. So I'm going to stop there and take some questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for this beautiful talk. Are there any questions from the audience? None, it was all so clear.
So we have all known the personal disagreement that T.D. Lee and C.N. Yang have had. So I had this brilliant idea that we would name our main auditorium in ICTP as Yang Lee Auditorium. So, but I didn't want to do it without their permission. So there was a Chinese scientist, Yu Lu, in our center. So I asked him if he would go talk to them privately. And both of them were happy for the auditorium to be named after them, that him, but not them together. So I just want to tell you that.
So in fact, thank you.
End up naming it after.
Thank you.
But it's obvious why. Is it Li Yang or Yang Li?
I mean, it has to be Yang Li.
Why?
Yang is
older?
Not only older, in my opinion, more distinguished scientist.
Oh, but that's different.
That's my personal
view. Yeah, sure. Any other suggestions or comments? So, well, I must tell you, because not everybody was here, but on the same dispute, for the 50th anniversary of the non-conservation of parity, we had a very nice session that was about 5 years ago, something, in 96. And so, of course, Li and Yang were invited and spoke, and many other people who had participated in the experiments at that time. The problem was they wouldn't sit in the same room. So I had to organize two sessions, one in before lunch and one after lunch. One spoke before lunch, one spoke after lunch. But I must admit that Li did not go to Yang's half, but Yang did come to Li's half, and the roof did not come off. So maybe there's hope someday to do something. Anyway, there's no question that the Chinese contribution to American science has been enormous, and it's appreciated, and I hope continued collaboration between the countries will continue. But I'm absolutely amazed at some of these documents, which I had not known. Well, thank you. I would like to thank all the speakers this afternoon. We had a wonderful afternoon, and this migration discussion, because there's much more to say. Thank you very much.
You.
Oh, wait a minute.
No.
Oh, you want to talk?
I just want to get it.